Blog Talk Radio.
This looks like a job for
Super Chicken.
You get the super sauce. I'll don my super suit.
Welcome to the Chicken Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer. We're having a little training session here with Andy and me. I've got the controls, which is the second time, so please forgive us if it's if it's a little awkward. Anyway, this the Chicken Whisperer is brought to you by ManaPro, providing the best quality products. Yes, I did say something. Okay, providing the best quality products that your animals deserve at a value you can appreciate. It's ManaPro, featuring live. Whisper, are you online now?
I am. Are you there?
I am. I'm sort of babbling here, but I am here, so at least we both got online.
No problem. Let me go ahead and we'll officially start this, and then I'll explain kind of everybody what's going on. All righty. So let's. That's fine.
Glad
not a
know.
Problem. We're,
okay.
We're doing just well. So hang on just a second, everybody. Just one second.
Take a licking. There is someone waiting who will hurry up and rescue you. Just call for Super Chicken.
Welcome to Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer, brought to you by ManaPro, providing the best quality products that your animals deserve at a value you can appreciate. ManaPro, nurturing life. My name is Andy Schneider, but most know me as the Chicken Whisperer. My co-host is poultry advocate and author of City Chicks, Chicken Tractor, and other great titles, Pat Borman. Today is Tuesday, June 14th, and I would like to thank all of you for tuning in this afternoon on Blog Talk Radio. This is a live radio show that is broadcast around the world. This radio show is all about keeping backyard poultry, show poultry, and living a self-sufficient lifestyle. You can follow the Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer radio show 24 hours a day at our website, chickenwhisperer.com. That's chickenwhisperer.com. If you're listening live today on Blog Talk Radio, I invite you to join us in the live chicken chat room that's going on right now. You can talk with other Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer fans and other chicken owners from around the country. You can also ask any questions you may have for our special guest when we have them on. All you have to do is click on the Chat Now button at our homepage there at Blog Talk Radio. In most cases, the chat room automatically opens up below. Just scroll down a little bit. The chat room should open up, and you'll be right there with everybody else. Now, we would like for you to take a moment to register. There's a button there that says register to participate in the chat room. Take a moment to register. That'll get you your own unique, fun, and creative screen name. Then you can come on in, sit a spell, have a great time, meet some new friends, and talk all about our hobby and passion and lifestyle of backyard poultry, show poultry, sustainable living, preparedness, urban farming, urban gardening, and a whole lot more. I would also like to invite you to mark this radio show as a favorite and request to be on our friends list while you're there at Blog Talk Radio. We hope you'll take a moment to do this today. And again, I want to thank you all for tuning in to Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer, brought to you by ManaPro. ManaPro is committed to providing the best quality products that your animals deserve at a value you can appreciate. No matter the animal, no matter the product, you can be certain that ManaPro cares as much about the well-being of your flock as you do. So try one of the many poultry products offered at a retailer near you. ManaPro, nurturing life. If you have experienced the disappointment of broken or weak eggshells, try ManaPro's Oyster Shell. Adding oyster shell to your flock's feeding program helps provide the calcium they need for strong eggshells. So don't let those beautiful eggs go to waste. Try ManaPro's Oyster Shell for your pullets and layers. Mount Healthy Hatcheries has been a hatching tradition for over 80 years. Home of the healthiest chicks, Mount Healthy Hatcheries offers a wide selection of bantams, turkeys, guineas, ducks, pheasants, and of course, meat birds and layers. Order online at mounthealthy.com. That's mthealthy.com. Or give them a call at 1-800-451-5603. Don't forget to ask about their free bonus chicks offer. Mount Healthy Hatcheries, home of the healthiest chicks. Looking for something? Find it online at Bidbird Auctions. Bidbird.com is an online auction service that caters specifically to the poultry, waterfowl, game bird, and pigeon hobbyists. With so many rare and exciting species listed daily and in a wide variety of categories, you'll want to visit often. Join hundreds of the nation's top breeders that have made Bidbird Auctions their new home. And get sold on Bidbird. You need an incubator, think Brensea, the incubation specialist. Brensea has been a world-leading manufacturer of incubators for over 30 years. Incubators from 7 to 380 eggs with high-quality electronic and digital controls, including precise humidity control and programmable egg turning, all at surprisingly affordable prices. Visit them online at Brensea.com. Brensea spelled B-R-I-N-S-E-A. That's Brensea.com or call 1-888-667-7009. Enter the coupon code WHISPER at checkout and save 10% on their incubators, brooders, egg handlers, and other incubation accessories. When you need an incubator, think Brensea. Technology you can trust. Critter-Cages.com is your one-stop shop for all your critters' housing needs. They stock a wide selection of supplies and equipment for rabbits, guinea pigs, hamsters, mice, rats, ferrets, chinchillas, chickens, and other small critters. Their chicken selection includes chicken barns, chicken coops, and chicken yards from top manufacturers. Your critters will love their selection of quality products, and you'll love their low prices. Visit them online at critter-cages.com. That's critter-cages.com.
And the mighty bird against prejudice continues his fight for law and order. So when you hear that cry in the sky, you'll know it's Super Chicken.
All righty, thank you very much for staying with us today on Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer. It is now time to bring on my wonderful poultry advocate and author, multi-talented Pat Foreman. Hey, Pat.
Hey, Whisper. Here we are. It's going to be a fun day. I feel like I've had caffeine, even though I haven't. I'm all up. This switchboard has me a little nervous here, so if I bungle along, listeners, just kind of cluck along with us here. Boy, it's a gorgeous day here in the Shenandoah Valley. I've got to tell you, it is just like a perfect. I feel like I'm living in a painting. It's so pretty. How are you doing? You must be all packed up and ready to head out of Dodge.
We're getting there. Let me go ahead and explain to everybody kind of what's going on today. Without a doubt, we know for sure that we will have a show tomorrow. We will welcome, in fact, tomorrow being the third Wednesday of the month. It's another great show of Garden Wise Living with Arlena. That is tomorrow. And so great garden show, as always, tomorrow. But I will not be joining us. Tomorrow is the big, big move. And so Pat will be running the show tomorrow. And we have utmost respect and trust that Pat's going to do a fabulous job. If not, you can send your complaints to Pat at Good Earth Publications. I'm sure you will do absolutely fine. And so, Pat, we're kind of working it out as far as signing on and kind of how the system works with two people in there and whatnot. So Pat basically has the controls, and we'll see about, because I know, Pat, that there's a way that we can have you sign on in the future as co-host and have your own screen name versus Chicken Whisper /co-host. So right now, if you're in the chat room, don't let that confuse you. Pat today is Chicken Whisperer. So Pat is Chicken Whisperer in the chat room, and I am Chicken Whisperer, and then next to it says co-host. There you go. You can see there. Chicken Whisperer co-host is me today. Will the real Chicken Whisperer please stand up? So and then you can change whatever color and font you want to there, Pat, under Chicken Whisperer. So just to give you an idea. So we're experimenting a little bit because tomorrow, Pat, in fact, I'm leaving early today. So really after we bring on, after Chickens in the News and whatnot, and we bring on Jeanette Behringer with the American Livestock Breeds Conservancy, I'll be signing off saying, so long, happy trails. And then,
oh, you didn't tell me that.
I will be back. And then I will be back on Thursday, but because tomorrow, right during the show, I mean, that's the time that the wagons are leaving. The wagons are pulling out probably about the time the show starts tomorrow. So, yeah, so Pat has got control. And so of course, be gentle with her and be patient with her as she, because she has hosted before, but it was a little while ago, as she plays the commercials and kind of gets used to that. So it's not going to be an issue. And so, Pat, just to let you know right now, is as you're looking at the switchboard, you'll see all of the callers that some call in and listen. Some, like you can see right there, that's Midbird. That's Jesse Paul. That's Midbird there online. Number two, for example. So, yep. So you don't need to press that or anything. But when Jeanette calls in, she'll pop up in one of those, and then all you do when you want to bring Jeanette on is click where it says on air, right next to her number, and voila, she will be on air. So it's that simple. And maybe I can kind of stay on until she comes on and walk you through that. But nonetheless, folks, we have a great show lined up for you today. We are going to welcome Jeanette Behringer. She's with the American Livestock Breeds Conservancy. They come on once a month, which is, I guess, the second Tuesday of every month. We're so glad that they come on once a month, and they tell us all about amazing things and the work that they're doing with the breeds that they're trying to preserve, the heritage breeds. And they don't just do chickens. They do chickens and livestock. I mean, it's the whole nine yards. And so today we're going to deviate a little bit from poultry, and I believe we're talking about some horses, I think, during the show today. Is that right, Pat?
Yes, that's correct. It's going to be really interesting. We're talking about the Spanish colonial Spanish horse conservation program that they've got going. And some really interesting things are coming up with the genetics now that they've got the genetic testing program. So that'll be pretty cool. Yep.
Yeah, Pat, in fact, Midbird's right now trying to find, he's looking on the internet. You said you had hosted the show once before, so I'm sure that Midbird actually is searching Google and Bing and Yahoo, and I'm sure he's looking for you at the control panel, because I think we did get a snapshot of you running the Chicken Whisperer world, running the backyard poultry world at CW headquarters. We have this mammoth control panel. We push a button, and voila, we have instant access to chicken keepers from around the world. We have a hotline here, the big yellow phone. You know, the map phone was red, but the chicken phone is yellow. We have a chicken hotline phone here. It's yellow, and we can pick that up, and we have access to any city and any city in the country that's trying to change their laws, where we can just pick up that phone and it rings the yep app. So we're high tech here at Chicken headquarters here in the Chicken
Cave,
as we call it.
That's what it looks like to me sitting here now, Whisper. It looks very complicated. I know it's not. But
whatever you do, you don't want to press the eject button.
Oh, shoot. I came close. Oh, dear.
Oh, my God.
I mean, there's upload, there's stop signs everywhere, there's little buttons, there's a switchboard, there's hands waving, there's all kinds of stuff.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Cool.
Absolutely. Okay. So, but it's fun.
Yeah, I'll
once
never
you...
forget when I took my first airplane ride. I was taking lessons to fly a plane. I was dating a pilot at the time, so he was giving me lessons. And it just looked so horribly confusing. I thought I was just going to die. But after about the fifth or sixth time, and I could pretty well land it and take it off. So it'll...
Let me translate that for everybody. We just heard Pat talk about her flying lessons when she was actually dating a pilot. So let me translate that. It appears that Pat is a golden member of the Mile High Club. So yes. I had to translate that for all of my listeners based on your last comment, but it appears to me that Pat is a golden card-carrying member of the Mile High Club. How about that, Pat? I'm proud of you.
I'm not sure I know what that means, but I don't have a card. I don't have a card.
Oh, okay. There was never a card issued? Okay. Then you may be an honorary member of the Mile
High
Club.
We had a lot of fun up there.
That's exactly what I'm talking about. The Mile High Club. So that's why there was a little funky delay here at the beginning of the show. And someone in the chat room, Pat, if you noticed, they thought you might have dropped an S bomb. They are like, did Pat just say? You know, so I'm not going to repeat it. But
No.
And then knowing that we were trying to get everything done at the last minute to get things, you know, there's no telling what you might have heard live on the air. But, hey, you know, we're human, and the show must go on.
Oh, Lordy D. I think I'm going to go get some coffee. You'll have to excuse me.
Go ahead and have a double espresso while you're at it. That'll make things even more interesting.
For that. I got to breathe deeply here as it is. Let me just keep breathing deep. Okay.
Do you happen to know what number Jeanette's going to be calling from?
It would be 706. She's there. I think that's
706. She's in Atlanta? No. 706 is, that's Love for Poultry. That's Love for Poultry. So let me see.
Oh, okay. Let me check. I've got her here.
Hey, Jeanette, are you there?
No,
Okay. No problem. Yep, I wasn't sure. We have I'm just kind of going over this switchboard with Pat. And she normally doesn't call in this early, so I'm not sure. Area code 251.
I've got it in my address book. Check it here real fast. So.
Okay, 251 apparently has pressed 1 to want to speak to the host or the co-host. Let's see what they want.
Okay.
Calling in from 251, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, my name is Kathy, and tonight in Chickasaw, Alabama, the city votes if we can have chickens.
Ah, how about that? And that's in, pronounced, is it Chickasaw, is that what you said?
Yes, Chickasaw, Alabama.
And is that in Lower Alabama, Upper Alabama, near Birmingham? Whereabouts is that over in Alabama?
It is a suburb of Mobile in the very bottom.
Okay. Very down there. So you live in L.A.? Lower Alabama.
Yes, I do. Yes, I do.
We have a real live listener calling directly from L.A. Cool. So, what are some of the things that y'all have done there in the city to try to promote this, to try to get people educated on backyard poultry, whether it be passing out flyers, going door to door, getting petitions signed, showing up at the meetings to educate folks on how awesome backyard poultry are and how beneficial they are? What are some of the things y'all have done there?
That's We have done all of the above. I've set up a website called Cluck.
Awesome.
Chickasaw. Chicken lovers uniting in Chickasaw.
I love it.
Huge, huge. So that's the Facebook page for us chicken lovers.
Excellent. Excellent. One of the techniques that works really well, too, is to have everyone wear yellow or some sort of a T-shirt that identifies them, because they won't, usually the city council won't let you all stand up at the same time to show support. So pass out hats or pins or something that identifies the pro-poultry people.
That's a good idea, but I can put that out there. And I got all the package together for them, and they've all been looking at it, and they've all said how great this is, except for one. So I'm still working on him. I have till 7 o'clock tonight.
You said that's one of the council members there? So
yes.
So most of them are very much in favor of this. There's just one that's you just can't win over right now?
That's correct. We've been trying to tell him about sustainable living.
But that necessarily wouldn't mess up the vote. If one person voted no, it would still pass as far as the information you have now.
Right.
That's great. Of course, you want to try to educate them as well. What is his or her biggest problem with voting yes?
He believes that they are smelly and loud.
Okay. Has he ever had chickens before in his life? Or her life?
No, he hasn't. And he's never been around them. That's just what he has heard.
Oh, okay, gotcha. So that would be my biggest point there when I was talking to him. I was like, oh, really? Okay, so where did you get your degree in poultry science, sir?
Red book.
Exactly. So I'd be like, oh, how many chickens have you owned in your lifetime, sir? None. It's just what I've heard. Oh, okay, well, I heard the sky's green, too. That doesn't necessarily make it true. So yeah, I would kind of, of course, that would be my take on it, but that's just, I deal things a little bit different than most. So, let's see. So he just thinks smelly and loud. And so, and then, of course, if he talks about, well, that's what I've heard, who have you heard that from? Oh, I've talked to farmers around the area, or my great-grandfather lived on a farm, and then my next issue would be, that's moot. We're not talking about a farm. We're talking about an urban setting with 6 to 8 chickens, not 60,000 or 80,000. So, sure, if you have 60,000 chickens in a confined space, I can assure you they're probably going to smell. Try putting 60,000 people in your living room and see what kind of odors you're going to have. Yeah, I can put 6 people in my living room and everything's fine and dandy. If I put 6,000 people in my living room, things are going to start to get a little smelly and aggravated and not so happy. So you have to say, okay, do you know anybody that has just 6 chickens? Well, no, I don't. Well, then how do you know that's going to be smelly and loud if you don't know anybody? So I just kind of started analyzing what his comment was, and then basically, just rip it apart. That's absolutely moot. So, okay, what do you mean loud? Does the ordinance allow roosters?
No.
It does. So there you go. So you can say, hey, it doesn't even allow roosters. Have you even read the proposal, sir? You're saying chickens are loud. There are not going to be any roosters allowed according to this proposal. So I assure you that there's not, no crowing.
Here's the science. Whisper, I've got the science. A chicken clucking, a hen clucking at her loudest while laying an egg is about the same decibels as human conversation. That's how loud it is, whereas a rooster has the same decibel as a barking dog. And as far as the manure, a 40-pound dog poops 2/3 of a pound of poo, and 10 chickens poop 1/2 pound. So 10 chickens make less solid waste than a 40-pound dog.
Right.
There you go.
How can you argue that?
In your book, I bought your book and I copied and gave it to, and that was one of the 40-pound dog, and the chickens is one of the that I wrote in the proposal or the little package I put together. So your book was
excellent.
Absolutely wonderful and helpful. Thank you so much.
Use any of that that you find useful. That's what it's there for.
Yes, and I loved it. Thank you so much.
All right.
Tell us again where the meeting is and what time and where you're at.
Okay, Chickasaw, Alabama, which is a suburb of Mobile, Alabama. It's at Chickasaw City Hall at 7 p.m.
All right.
We're going to be sending good thoughts and prayers and have our fingers and toes crossed, and maybe you can give Pat a call tomorrow and let us know how that turned out. Maybe you can post it on our Facebook Chicken Whisperer page, and then maybe you can even give us a call tomorrow on the show and tell us how it all turned out and what the final vote was and what were, you know, if the person who was not really keen on it, what his final comments on that were. So now, what are some of the other, do you have to get your neighbor's permission? Is that written in there?
No, I didn't write that in there.
Good, very good. Very good. That's always unconstitutional and it's crazy. Not many people do, but we've seen it on occasion. So, yeah, definitely keep us updated regarding that. Well, congratulations. That's exciting. And we wish you all the luck. It sounds like you've done a fabulous job down there. And do keep us updated on that glorious news. If it passes, that's tremendous. One more step. And like Pat says, it's just, you know, with a lot of these cities that don't do it right now, they'll have to pretty much, they will come around. They're not going to have much choice in the matter as this movement actually continues across the country. But the good news is about what we find, 85%, 85 to 90% of the towns that approach changing the laws actually do. So you've got the odds that are in your favor, plus all your hard work is going to come into play, I think, tonight as well. So that's awesome, and I appreciate you giving us a call and letting us know about that. That's fabulous.
Yes, thank you. I have enjoyed the program very, very much as soon as I found it. But I will let you all know tomorrow how it turns out.
That sounds great. Give Pat a call tomorrow. She'll be running the boards, and I may have to go back and make a few bleeps here and there with her running the show, but but we'll I can always go and erase
those. Well, thank you all very much.
Thank you. Take care. Good luck tonight.
Bye bye.
Okay, Pat, this is, it looks like, and I'm pretty sure, 919 is the area code there in North Carolina, so I'm going to let you go ahead and click that, Pat, on the switchboard, and we'll go ahead and bring our friend Jeanette Behringer live on the show. So, Pat, why don't you go ahead and take over the controls, and Pat, you there?
Yep, I'm just trying to focus and squint and see where it says on the air. Yes, Jeanette, are you with us here?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Okay, yeah, you are live. This is Jeanette Behringer from the American Livestock Breeds Conservancy. Welcome to the show, Jeanette. Jeanette, I got to warn you right up front, we're having an interesting show because I'm running the controls. So I'm generally not a control person in these areas anyway. But so funny things might happen.
Okay, wait, so give me the heads up.
Yeah, Jeanette, are you on the speakerphone?
If
you can get on the regular line, it gives us a little bit of a feedback. It sounds like you're kind of in the back of a chicken coop when you're talking.
How's that?
That's
is
much
that better.
Thank you.
Okay.
Yes, much better. Okay.
Yeah. So I was talking with John Hall a little while ago, and he wanted me to ask Andy, is he getting any sleep yet?
Yeah, it hasn't really been too bad. Thank you. It's interesting. It's about 50-50 right now as far as the feeding schedule. About half the time, Jen kind of delegates when he's going to get fed based on her comfort level and the time and her alarm clock that she sets, making sure he's getting the nutrition that he needs. And then the other half of the time, then he pretty much will let us know when he's hungry, and we'll feed him then. So, you know, it hasn't been, you know, I say nightmare that you always hear from a lot of folks, oh, you're not going to get any sleep. You know, you just basically try to sleep when you can, sleep when he's sleeping if you can, you know, that type of thing. Sometimes I'll take control, and yes, he'll sleep a lot longer if obviously it's being held versus in the bassinet. So if I want Jen to have some extra sleep, then I'll make sure that I hold him. I did that the other night because she was really getting weary.
So I said, okay, I'll take it. So I took the root wheel, if you will, and held him and stayed awake for about four and a half. Could have been even touching 5 hours, so she could get at least, you know, that good sleep.
You're a trooper.
So we're trying, you know, it hasn't been the horror stories that a lot of people experience with, oh my gosh, all night, just horrible screaming and crying. He's really good. And bravo, like I said, in the chat room for Jen, and pretty much, you know, we know when he really needs to be fed, and he's really on that schedule. Before, up until probably about 3 days ago, it was pretty much Jen's schedule based on her comfort level, and feeding and knowing when he needed to be fed. But he's gotten on that same schedule as too. So thank you very, very much for that and the comment. And it's been really fun. And I shared, Jeanette, I guess it was yesterday on the radio show. It was a fun. I commented last night yesterday at a late lunch we had with some friends. I was like, you know, you're a very, very new parent. You know, you're a very new parent the day before yesterday, I was preparing supper for Jen, and I heard it was either a made me cry or like a young child on a big wheel outside, or, you know, just the sound of children. And I was in the kitchen preparing dinner, and you know you're a new parent when you look out the window to see where the sound is coming from, and then you suddenly realize that that's coming from inside my house. So yeah, you know you're a new parent when you hear the sound of little children and you look out the window to see where that sound is coming from. Lo and behold, it's coming within your house. And then another thing you'll appreciate is that I put on my Facebook page, which you might have seen, I put multitasking is breastfeeding your son while at the same time eating a spaghetti dinner with buttered bread. All at the same time. It just happened to me. Supper fell about the time she was having to feed, and so she had baby in one hand, and I set the plate next to her, and eating a spaghetti meat sauce spaghetti dinner while feeding can be obviously a challenge. But then it was quite funny that the comment that got the most laughs was, I put, "Don't worry, honey, I'll make sure I get all the spaghetti stains out of your nursing bra. No problem." So yeah,
I remember those days. Mine's 16, so she's
wow, 16. So you remember?
She's still pretty labor intensive, but not quite that level. She lets me sleep at night anyway.
Absolutely. At least you sleep with one eye open.
Yeah, that's true. Although the dogs usually let me know if anything's going on. But
there you go. Absolutely.
Yeah,
I got a lot of comments from moms that were saying, yes, it's amazing the multitasking we can do and what we've done. Somebody was said that they were feeding while, you know, cooking and holding the oven door open with one of their knees while they were cooking on the stove. It was just funny, some of the comments that were made of memories of them multitasking when it was so funny. Yeah, we've got the sling and the papoose and I forget all the official names of them, but she loves those. So absolutely, we've got all of that from the chat room. So, but thanks for asking, Jeanette. It's a wonderful time in our life, and we've got so much going on. We're moving to our little a homestead tomorrow. The truck will be pulling out around noon, and we'll say goodbye to John's Creek, thank the Lord, and then heading down that way. So that's why today we've got Pat kind of running the controls, and then tomorrow she'll be pretty much solo, but she's doing a fabulous job.
Excellent. Well, I thought today maybe we could talk a little bit about horses.
Okay.
ALBC does a lot of work with Colonial Spanish horses, and it's an up-and-coming group of horses that people are discovering that, you know, bigger isn't necessarily better, and that a lot of these Colonial Spanish horses are really a great choice, especially for small farms or people that just want a good, hardy horse that's an easy keeper and can still look drop-dead gorgeous. And what I find exciting about the Colonial Spanish horses is that, you know, in just about every section of the country, you have different strains within the Spanish horses. And so it's great for me when people call up the office and they're asking for suggestions on you know, what kind of horse should I get? You know, I'll pull out my map and look at, you know, okay, which one of the Spanish horse populations live in that particular region. And a lot of times you get a perfect fit with the breed in its region, and having Mother Nature work with you instead of against you, you end up having a much healthier and hardier animal because it's adapted to that area. So I thought it'd be kind of fun to talk about those. We've also had some new scientific data coming in on the strains, and we continue to work on that and expand it and actually keep colonial Spanish horses myself. I got marsh tackies out on our farm, and they've just been a blast. Although I had an incident last week that, you know, horses is just never a dull moment, and we've had our challenges, but they've been a delight. And are you familiar with the colonial Spanish horses, or?
I am not.
Yeah.
No.
Well, they're we call them colonial Spanish.
They speak Spanish.
These are animals that.
They name with a.
Yeah. Well, these horses, they represent the animals that came over to the Americas with the original Spanish settlers and conquistadors. And the interesting thing about those genetics is back in Spain, these animals no longer exist. And so you have here in America this snapshot of the golden age of horse breeding in Spain. And the Spanish actually value it quite a bit because, you know, in Spain they continue to refine a lot of the Spanish breeds. And some of them are a little bit over-the-top refined, you know, like in the case with the Andalusians. You know, they're so refined now. They're not the rough and tough cow horse they were once upon a time. And so these horses have genetics that go way, way back in the U.S. They were first arriving in the late 1500s. You know, Christopher Columbus brought some over. Some of the explorers in the 1600s brought some more. And then shortly after that, horse importation staved off a bit because there were sufficient populations in the Americas to sustain what they needed for use here. And one of the misconceptions that people have about these horses is, you know, when you think of the conquistadors, you think of the, you know, the beautiful destriders and war horses that they used. And really, when you think about it, it didn't make much sense to pack up an extremely valuable war horse and take the chance of putting it in a boat and crossing the Atlantic, hoping it's going to make it over here, and then finding a food source that's going to be sufficient to sustain that animal. And so a lot of times what would happen is, you know, they'd have their war horses, but they would go to the coast and they would buy the local horses that were, you know, running wild, rough, utilitarian-type horses, and those are the ones that actually made it over to the colonies first. And then later on when you had the plantations and settlements developed, then they would bring, you know, some of the more expensive horses over because they were fairly sure that they were going to be able to provide for those horses and that the locals wouldn't eat the horses at that point. And so, you know, all of these horses, if you take that into consideration, they come from very hardy stock. I mean, they made it across that huge ocean voyage and then came over here and had to survive on pretty rough forage. And a lot of these horses are still very classically Spanish. And when I say that, they look a bit different. Like if you look at we could talk about butts. Butts are one of the big telltale signs. When you're looking at a colonial Spanish horse compared to like a quarter horse has a, you know, big round butt, and then you've got the Spanish horse that has kind of a slanted rear end, and it's not quite as broad. And what it does is kind of allow better dexterity in their hindquarters because their rear end is a bit slanted. Their rear legs can get underneath them more efficiently, And so these horses can react very quickly, and they're very athletic. And he also compared to, again, like a quarter horse, when you look at them from the front, there's a deception in their body in that they have they look really thin-chested from the front. But when you look at them from the side, they've got a very deep chest. And what this is an adaptation that enables them to radiate heat more effectively. It's kind of like thinking about a roast beef. As you cut that roast beef and make it thinner, it's going to cool off a lot faster. One of the things that Colonial Spanish horses are famous for is their stamina. And part of that is their ability to cool off really quickly. And also that big, deep chest gives them great lung capacity and also good heart capacity. And so they really are very efficiently put together. And the other thing we look for is nice, broad foreheads, because the other factor we see often with these animals is they're pretty level-headed horses. They're thinking horses, and they've got this nice, broad head to allow for great brain capacity. And they really are premeditated in a lot of what they do. You know, like my horses, when they get frightened, they don't just run off in a blind fright. They'll start a little bit, but then they'll turn around to see what the heck's going on rather than slamming into a tree or just running for the opposite end of the field. So, you know, they're a thinking horse. And the other attribute to mention about them is these horses are very people-oriented. Spanish horses typically like to be around people, and that's one of the greatest factors in choosing them as like a family horse in particular, because many of them have been selected for a long time to be people-oriented and gentle, and that can be a real plus. You know, I was at a friend's place just this past week up in Washington, and she had this beautiful Morgan that I saw off in the distance, you know, and he came running over to us, and the first thing he did was pin his ears and, you know, give attitude. And, you know, with our horses, they come running up and, you know, they're like, where's the food? You know, they don't have the attitude. And I was holding a carrot in my hand, and that horse was still kind of, you know, uppity. But anyways, these horses are pretty neat, and they're critically endangered when you look at each of the different strains. And we've got quite a good number of strains that ALBC works with, and they each have a really great story. You know, we start out with, like, the banker horses up in North Carolina, which is our neck of the woods. We have several populations on different islands, and we just got back some DNA work that substantiates that the Shackleford horses that were sampled do, in fact, still have the genetics of Spanish horses. And this was also confirmed for the Marsh Tackies of South Carolina and the Florida Crackers. And those three strains seem to be somewhat interrelated, and that makes sense. They're all on the East Coast. They came from horses that were brought up from the Caribbean. And, you know, it was nice to have the DNA substantiate the historic accountings of where these horses came from. The banker horses, they're typically smaller, and the longer they're off island and bred in captivity, the bigger they've been getting. But if you've got a banker right off the island, they're pretty small. They're pony, large pony size, but they don't look squat or thick. They're very refined looking, so they look like a small horse. They don't look like a stout pony or anything like that. And the folks out here, the bankers really generate a lot of interest from the tourism trade. And interestingly, they're clashing with people in the same token, in that especially up near Corolla, people are encroaching on their habitat with their big McMansions and waterfront property, and kind of forcing the horses out of the areas they're used to free roaming. And, you know, when you find these horses in your backyard, a lot of folks don't know how to behave around wild horses and think of them as pets that you can just shoo away and get in between a stud horse and his mare, and, you know, that causes trouble. Mm-hmm. But the banker horses have just been named the official state horse in North Carolina. And,
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so they're
enjoying. But you said which horse is that, Jeanette? The bank horse?
Banker, you know, that's slang for the Outer Banks, and those are the islands along the coast of North Carolina. And
Banker, okay.
Yeah, and they lumped all of those together to say that the colonial Spanish horse is the official state horse in North Carolina, so that included all the bankers. And
okay.
Yeah, and there's a good number of people out in the coast that have them, and there are a few adoption programs because most of these horses are still managed in a feral state, but they need to occasionally take off horses that are overrepresented within the herd or need to be removed for whatever reason. And so there are ways to adopt these horses. I think you can adopt them for like $500 or $800, something like that, and have a really nice little horse to work with. I don't know if they'd be broke, but, you know, they colonial Spanish horses typically are pretty easy to train. So
are they good with kids, too, Jeanette?
They can be, yeah. You know, like I said, they're very people-oriented, and it seems in particular they know when they're around kids, you know. And I've seen, like, when my daughter was little, we'd walk into herds of dozens of horses, and she never felt threatened. And I mean, I was keeping an eagle eye on her. And even with the horses that were known to kind of kick up their heels, she'd walk up to them and they'd just sniff her and be sweet. And I mean, I'm sure there are exceptions out there, but all in all, they are a pretty decent pick for kids. And, you know, as we go down the coast, we get South Carolina, we get the Marsh Tacky, who is the official state heritage horse of South Carolina now. That happened last year. And they're a particular favorite of mine because, you know, we have them at our farm. But they have a fabulous history that I've yet found in any other breed I've worked with ALBC. And over the past 5 years, I've been doing a lot of historical digging to try and get a full picture of what this breed is all about. And in that research, we've been able to determine and prove that these horses were used during the American Revolution, and in particular with the men that followed Francis Marion, you know, the famous Swamp Fox. And,
the Swamp Fox, right.
Yeah, and I always like to say that, you know, Marion was an amazing tactician, but people need to give credit to the fact that his men were riding the ultimate all-terrain vehicle in the swamp.
At the time, the Marsh Tacky, huh?
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, these are smaller horses. They've got broad feet. They have a special gait that enables them to avoid being stuck in the mud. And when they are stuck, they don't panic. They just lay on their side, kick out their heels, and get themselves unstuck. And, you
really?
Know, I haven't seen it myself because I haven't gotten stuck in the mud, but I've had several friends of mine that go, they're serious riders and hunters, and they've gotten themselves in situations like that. And they said, sure enough, their horse just lays down and kicks out and gets out of it. And these horses know how to avoid stump holes pretty easily, and they can also thrive on the challenging vegetation down there. And if you can imagine one force riding those kind of horses, and then you've got the British that are out there riding their big warm bloods, you know, it's no wonder that the Brits could never catch Marion, you know, because their horses just couldn't keep up. And interestingly, though, the British got their hands on some Marsh Tackies because they had lost a bunch of their horses at sea during a storm when they were going to Savannah. And they had to use the local horses in order to take Charleston. and it's documented. They were actually riding marsh tackies when they took Charleston, which is pretty.
Oh, for heaven's sakes.
Yeah, and then another interesting tidbit with them is in looking at the weird place, but Frank Lloyd Wright, the famous architect, he designed one southern plantation in his career, which happened to be in South Carolina, and he specifically designed stables to suit marsh tackies. So I got to say, how many horses have had stables designed for them by Frank Lloyd Wright? No.
Well, now how's the design different for the marsh tacky if you're designing this? You put mud in so they can get in it and get out, or?
Well, they're smaller. They're much smaller than your typical stall for the riding horses. And the plantation had two sets of stables. One was for the pleasure horses, and then you had a set of stables for the hunting horses. And the hunting horses were the tackies, because that was the only way to get really into the thick of the low country in South Carolina. And they're right up next to the dog kennels, so they were smaller, and they were also positioned near the dog kennels so that they'd be desensitized to, you know, dogs barking all the time.
Oh.
And,
okay.
Yeah, so it kind of made sense. But the tackies have been great. You know, they're heat tolerant, and their feet are really solid here in the wet and the muck. They very, very rarely, if ever, have hoof problems. And interestingly, in doing DNA study of the breed, the horses that had bad feet were not pure marsh tackies when we did DNA on them. And so, you know, it's all on the feet with them. And they also are not frightened of water obstacles. I've been told by some of the old-timers that if they're afraid of the water, they're not a tacky. And so,
really?
Yeah. So they've been pretty interesting. And then another closely related animal to them would be the Florida Cracker Horse. And this is another one. The Marsh Tacky and the Florida Cracker are fairly closely related, although there are differences genetically. But a lot of the early Marsh Tackies came from horses that were actually traded by the American Indians, and they would go and get horses down in the St. Augustine settlement, and then they would use those horses to use them as pack animals for deer skin, and then they would hunt deer up the coast, come to Charleston, sell the deer skins, sell the horses, and then go back down to St. Augustine to do it all over again. So it's actually the Native Americans that had a pretty big influence on the marsh tacky in bringing a lot of Spanish horses up this way. But
well,
the crackers, over the years, they became a little more refined. And most people don't know this, but cowboys prefer gated horses, or they did back in the day. And Florida was the heart of the cattle industry before everything kind of moved west. There was a huge cattle industry and culture in Florida, and it was these cracker horses that were used as cow horses. As a result, there are a lot of gated crackers out there, and they're still very much really good cow horses. They've got that natural sense on how to work around cattle and they're a comfortable ride. You know, if you think about it, you're in the saddle all day. The last thing you want is a teeth jarring ride.
Explain to our listeners, Jeanette, what gated means in horses. What does it mean to have a gated horse?
It means they have a special way of moving so that when you're, like, trotting along, rather than, you know, bouncing up and down, when you're sitting on the back, you actually remain level. It's just a very smooth ride. Like, you don't have to, for people that ride, you know, you don't have to post, you know, the action of standing up, sitting down, so that your butt's not banging on the saddle when you're trotting. And with gated horses, you know, you could balance an egg on a spoon riding them with the really good ones. And a lot of the Florida Cracker horses are gated. So it's very smooth ride. If you got back problems, you want a gated horse.
So a lot of these Spanish breeds, the heritage Spanish breeds, are gated.
Any given population of Spanish horses, you are guaranteed to have at least some percentage, and I can't remember if it was about 20%, are going to be gated. And that's just part of the characteristic of a Spanish horse. We've been working on a gated horse study on the different strains of the Spanish horses, and we've just started on it. But some really interesting information has come out of this. We've been working with the University in Mississippi, and when they analyzed the gait of, like, the Marsh Tacky, for instance, they studied the locomotion and broke it down and tried to establish, is this a gated horse or not? Well, they were able to answer that, and the answer is yes, all Marsh Tackies gait to some extent. Some do it more than others. But the really interesting thing is that the locomotion within that gait enables the horse to have very few feet on the ground simultaneously at any given time, meaning if that horse gets stuck in the mud with one foot, the other three are in motion, and it helps to keep them from getting stuck in the mud. And so It's really difficult to see with the naked eye how they explain it, but when you look at it shot by shot and how they broke it down, it really is a unique gait, and they believe that it's an adaptation to the wet and marshy terrain that they're on. And then the other one we looked at was the Wilbur Cruz horses, and they're from Arizona, very different type of environment. And it's very rocky, hilly. You had to have really tough feet and be able to deal with the rocks. And when they broke down the gait of the Wilbur Cruz, it was almost the opposite from the Marsh Tacky in that they had more feet on the ground simultaneously, which allows them to have better footing on rocky terrain. And so, the researchers are saying, now if you were to switch these two horses around, you know, Wilbur Cruz would be more likely to get stuck in the mud in South Carolina because of its gait, and the Marsh Tacky wouldn't be quite as sure-footed as the Wilbur Cruz would be on that rocky terrain. So I'm kind of excited. I'm hoping to film some banker horses this summer or maybe in the fall. I'm just not sure when I'm going to get out there. But they're on sandy terrain, so it'll be kind of interesting to see if they've got a gait that's adapted for the sand. And, the university is really excited about doing this because it's an interesting collection of breeds that, you know, are kind of related to each other but have evolved independently in different types of terrain. And so from a locomotion standpoint, it's a really interesting study to see locomotion as an adaptation to a particular environment. So
does breeding then, does the form follow function type of thing? Do they have a different skeletal structure to have these different gaits that is perpetuated by the breeding?
Doesn't seem to be that we see thus far. Some of the horses are a little thicker bone than the others, and that may be part of the function. Like the Marsh Tackies, they're a little thicker boned, but I think they also were a more do-it-all kind of horse where they were, you know, they were pulling a plow, they were carrying loads, they were hunting horses. Florida Cracker seemed to be a little more refined, but I don't believe skeletal structure is all that different. They have the same kind of angles in their shoulders and their croups. And the one thing that's consistent with all of these strains is that they're all very well balanced in that when you look at what Mother Nature intended for a horse to be put together, this is pretty much the model she would have used. Very well balanced. legs aren't too long, head isn't too small, neck is the right proportion. And you take, I need a picture to demonstrate it, but there are a number of measurements on the horse that when you compare them all, they're equal in length in multiple distant parts of the body. But the bottom line, I guess, is that the way these horses are put together puts the least amount of strain on their joints, and so they end up having much more efficient locomotion, less wear and tear on their joints, on their feet, and that's why they live a long time, too. They don't break down and fall apart when they're 12 or 13. You know, these horses, they stay pretty fit and rideable to a ripe old age, and one of the mares a friend of mine has, her last foal she gave birth to at 28 years of age. I mean, she was...
Really?
And she,
oh, my gosh.
She did okay. You know, I mean, she wasn't a spring chicken, but she was able to deliver that foal, nurse that foal, and it did fine. And, you know, that's not an unheard-of situation with a lot of these horses.
Wow, that's and 28 years, that's what's the equivalent in people years to that?
pretty darn old, say.
Pretty darn old, yeah. I know a dog is like, dog is 7 to 1, I think it is. So
yeah.
That is really amazing.
Oh, yeah, wow, and she was a very classic, traditional marsh tacky. And the owner had had her since she was a foal, so he knew exactly how old she was.
Wow.
So it was amazing. But, you know, as we go west, we've got an interesting population called the Choctaw, and that's out in Oklahoma.
Huh?
And you ever seen that movie Hidalgo?
Yes, I love that movie.
Yeah, you know, in the end of the movie where they all get released onto the mountain and they're running free and all that, well, they got kicked off the mountain a few years ago. Their lease was up. And so ALBC was involved with a huge rescue of about 300 horses that needed to get off of the mountain before the landlord started taking action. And so...
Wow.
That was an interesting project, and myself and my colleague Margie Bender, we were tasked with going out to out in the field and photo documenting and getting the pedigrees of all the horses, and then getting that into the stud book, and then searching for new stewards that could take on some of the horses, because the gentleman who controlled the herd only had enough land for maybe, you know, a quarter of those horses at the time. And so it was a huge project, but it was thrilling to be out there with all those horses. And it was a testament to the dedication of the guy who kept him in that, you know, honest truth, he knew every single horse out there and who they were related to. He could name sire and dam. And you know, he couldn't give you exact birth date, but he could give you roughly what year they were born. And just amazing that he had all this knowledge in his head. And I mean, there was no hesitation. He was not pulling names out of a hat. You know, it was pretty intense. And there's still a need for people to get involved with Choctaw horses, because he's still got a number that could be placed in the hands of new stewards. And so any listeners out there interested in Choctaw horses, there is a need for them.
Can they contact you if they're interested in that, Jeanette?
Yeah, sure. They can contact the office, and we could put them in touch with the gentleman or the group of people that are managing the rest of the horses. But, you know, they've still got well over 100, and so I'm sure there's some available. But that was
okay.
One of the...
I just posted your phone number in the chat room, Jeanette, so
okay.
If people are interested, here they come.
Great.
Yeah.
So
yeah. Very good.
Continue west, we've got Wilbur Cruz in Arizona. Those are ranch horses that were brought up from Mexico back in the 1800s, and they were, you know, good for cow horses, and And these ones, they're noted for having some really neat paints, and they're also known for having really good temperaments, and they're really classic Spanish-looking, beautiful heads.
Which breed is this, Jeanette, that you're talking about?
Wilbur Cruz.
Wilbur, how do you spell that? W-I-L-B?
C-U-R, and then a hyphen, C-R-U-C-E.
Okay, Wilbur Cruz horses. So there's the original cowboy horses, huh?
Yeah. You know, they say that they originated from the famous Father Kino missions in Mexico. That's where the stock came from. And Father Kino was a famous missionary who bred a lot of really fine animals at that mission, in particular horses. So it's pretty interesting genetics with a neat history. And
wow.
We have some feral strains out there, like Mount Taylor and the Baca horses out in New Mexico, Cerbet horses in Arizona, and we've got Sulfur horses in Utah. And the furthest north...
Sulfur horses?
Yes.
What? Sulfur, like the S-U-L-F-U-R?
Yes.
Sulfur horses, okay.
Yeah.
I've never heard of so many of these, but amazing. Go ahead, I'm sorry. And why were they called sulfur horses?
The sulfur, I think it was from the valley they came from, if I remember right. They're also classically Spanish, and they tend to be a little bit bigger than some of the other Spanish strains, and I believe originally the sulfur horses were from California, and then the population moved into Utah, and they do have some association with some of the Native American peoples in that area, and today they're I think they're not. There are very few that are wild in remote areas, but most of them are in the hands of breeders now. And then another real interesting one that came to our attention just a few years ago is the Santa Cruz horse. And when the DNA was done on these, it shows that they have the closest relationship to Peruvian and Colombian Paso Finos. And those are... highly gated Spanish horses in Latin America. And
they're beautiful, yeah.
Yeah, and when you look at these Santa Cruz horses, they look like little Pasos. They're really beautiful horses. A lot of them are highly gated. And they were off the island of Santa Cruz, and they were originally brought there in the 1800s as ranch horses from stock down in Mexico. And they were used to herd sheep and cattle on the island. And after the sheep and cattle operations left, the horses were left to be feral. Interesting side note with these guys is that in the early age of film, when the Western movie first started to appear on the silver screen, a lot of the original silent film era Westerns were actually filmed on Santa Cruz Island, and they used these horses to be the cowboy horses on there. And so they have this really interesting connection with the film industry, and I'm always holding out that maybe some famous actor or director who has a love for Western film might someday take up the Santa Cruz cause, because they're probably the most endangered and most in need of help breed that we have out there as far as the horses go. The world population of Santa Cruz horses is under 50, and we're really needing
almost...
people that would be interested in becoming breeders, and in particular people that live in California, because you know, the population's so small, it kind of needs to be kept together so that it doesn't splinter and then you can't exchange stock when you need to very easily. We did get a big group of them that moved down to Florida, and there's a breeding population of about 15 down there, and then the rest of them are still up in California. They're all off the island, and they're up near north of Mendocino, but they're... Another interesting thing about them is there was one lady, her name's Christina Nooner, who has the Sunshine Sanctuary for horses and kids, and she uses all of these horses. She's got the majority of the Santa Cruz horses on that place, and she uses them all for as therapy horses for children in crisis. And what she found was even the horses that at one time were wild and just off the island, they still wanted to be around kids. And so it was a really great niche for these horses, and she still uses them as therapy horses and is trying desperately to find new stewards that can take on the breeding role, because it's getting hard for her to continue breeding a lot of horses because, wow, you know, the kids will end up, losing time that has to be used up for the horses. So that kind of takes east to west coast and our tour of colonial Spanish horses in America.
That was amazing. Listen, Jan, well, let's take a short commercial break, and then one other thing we talked about earlier that I'd like to explore a little bit more is after the break is how the genetics testing and the genome project is affecting the conservation and identification of the Spanish horses, or and what you're finding out. So we're talking today with Jeanette Barringer. She's with the American Livestock Breeds Conservancy. She's a technical program manager and research. And today we're talking about the heritage Spanish colonial Spanish horse conservation. We'll be back in just a moment. Stay tuned.
Hey, it's the Chicken Whisperer. If you're in the market for a new incubator, then look no further than GQF. They have a great selection of tabletop and cabinet-style incubators at prices you can afford. I love my GQF Genesis Model 1588. It has a large picture window and an automatic thermostat, which makes for a better hatch every time. Go pick out your new incubator at GQFradio.com. That's GQFradio.com. Critter-Cages.com is your one-stop shop for all your critters' housing needs. They stock a wide selection of supplies and equipment for rabbits, guinea pigs, hamsters, mice, rats, ferrets, chinchillas, chickens, and other small critters. Their chicken selection includes chicken barns, chicken coops, and chicken yards from top manufacturers. Your critters will love their selection of quality products, and you'll love their low prices. Visit them online at critter-cages.com. That's critter-cages.com. Pictures of chickens on aprons are common across America, but picture a chicken wearing an apron and you'll probably get a good chuckle. Laugh if you must, but nothing protects hens better than the Hen Saver Hen Apron. Hen Saver Hen Aprons protect your hens from the damage caused by an overly affectionate rooster and may even provide protection from an unexpected hawk attack. Hen Savers come in several different sizes to fit both bantam and standard-sized hens and roosters. Colors include camo, denim, navy, brown, khaki or black, and soon pink. Crazy K Farm is expanding its already colorful Hen Saver collection to include the color pink. A portion of their sales will be donated to organizations that fund breast cancer research and awareness. Order your Hen Saver aprons today at hensaver.com. That's hensaver.com. First State Vet Supply is your one-stop shop to keep your birds healthy and happy. They have a wide selection of medications, vaccines, vitamins, wormers, and much more. Every product comes with specific directions and doses for your small backyard flock. Have questions about a sick or injured chicken? Take advantage of First State Vet Supplies Ask the Chicken Doctor program. For just $25, you can have a personal phone consultation with Peter Brown, also known as the Chicken Doctor. The consultation fee is waived if you purchase a product from First State Vet Supply. Visit them online at firststatevetsupply.com. That's firststatevetsupply.com. McMurray Hatchery is the world's oldest and largest rare breed hatchery. They have been providing their customers quality poultry since 1917 and have more than 110 different breeds to choose from. Be sure to sign up for their weekly special email at McMurrayHatchery.com and receive a $5 internet exclusive coupon to use on your first internet order. McMurray Hatchery, the world's largest and oldest rare breed hatchery.
ManaPro understands that poultry owners are as diverse as the birds they care for, which is why they offer both medicated and non-medicated starters. Whichever product you choose, you know you're getting great nutrition for your new chick. Look for ManaPro products at a retailer near you. ManaPro, nurturing life.
Actually, in reality, I am Super Chicken.
And the mighty bird against prejudice continues his fight for law and order. So when you hear that cry in the sky, you'll know it's Super Chicken.
All righty. Welcome back to the Chicken Whisperer Talk Show. We're talking today with Jeanette Barringer. She's with the American Livestock Breeds Conservancy, and we're talking about colonial Spanish horse conservation. And my goodness, I had no idea there were so many different strains of the Spanish horses and that they played so much of a role in American history. I mean, from the very get-go of the colonies.
Go ahead. At one time was a lot more. There were a lot of strains that were associated with the different Native American tribes, and during the late 19th century, early 20th century, a lot of them disappeared because the military was often fond of throwing in, you know, different types of horses within feral populations, you know, throw in a draft horse to make them bigger or just shoot the horses. And so a lot of the tribal strains are lost. And, thankfully we've been able to save a good number of them. But, there were Spanish horses in every corner of the United States. Just over the years they've been crossbred or eradicated, and so we try to determine what feral populations are still pure and then do our best to keep them that way.
Okay. Well, and that leads right into the genome project. I mean, you were telling me before the show about how you were testing some of the Outer Bank horses and found they had Shetland. Was it Shetland in it? You thought they were pure Spanish but had another breed, so... So how are you using that now to track these horses and to identify which ones really need conservation efforts?
Well, the DNA is a tool, and it's part of a number of ways that we determine the status of the breeds. And in the case of that study, we're still trying to understand where the Shetland blood cropped up. Was it in one population that was off island and Shetland stud got in, or is this island wide? And so previous studies with that particular breed showed that they were pure Spanish, and now this new study is saying that there's Shetland incursion, and it wouldn't have been recent Shetland incursion, it would have been a while ago. So we haven't come out with any any plan of action at this point because we're still trying to investigate, okay, how come these results are different? But what is really interesting is that the really positive things that came out of the DNA study was that it reinforced the fact that, you know, the Florida Cracker horses, Marsh Tacky horses, and Shackelford Banks are all somewhat related, and that is completely in line with the historic information we have on them. The other neat thing that we've learned with the DNA testing is that DNA is great, but a lot of times your eye can tell you a lot about horses and if they've got any incursion from other breeds or not. And in particular, Phil Sponnenberg is fabulous at this. He's been mentoring myself and my colleagues in developing an eye for type. And a lot of chicken people have that really good. You know, the judges, they can look at a chicken and tell you if there's something crossed in with it. And the same thing with the horses. It's pretty easy to pick out little traits that just aren't typical in a Spanish horse and makes you think, you know, I don't think they're pure. And like with the tackies, I said earlier, the horses that had bad feet, all of their DNA came back that they were crossed. You know, so, you know, that's one little clue that if you see a horse with bad feet within that population, you have to put up a question mark. A lot of times it's ear set or tail set. You know, if the tail's too high, the ears are too small. You know, when you develop that eye for type, it's really gratifying that you can support that with the DNA evidence. And, you know, in a lot of cases, if we're working with feral animals, you might not be able to collect that DNA, and that's where the skill of developing that eye comes in play. This particularly pertinent, like with cattle, because not too many cattle are going to let you walk up to them and grab their tails and pluck hairs. You to get into trouble. But you can take a good look at a cow, and, you know, it's pretty easy to pick out if they've got Hereford in them or Angus in them or Jersey or what have you. Like with the Colonial Spanish horses, we have Colonial Spanish cattle that we work with, and they've got telltale signs just like the horses and the goats, for that matter. We work a lot with Colonial Spanish goats, and they're very particular in the way they should look, and the ones that don't conform to that, 9 times out of 10, they're probably not purebred. So, you know, the technology's fabulous, but Sponnenberg, he's proved time and time again that an experienced eye can be just as accurate as the DNA.
Wow, that's their, and I know with the poultry, sort of, it's also their fingers. It's the feel of the bird as
sure.
they go through their confirmation, which is an art. My gosh, which
oh
is,
yeah,
I'd like to learn. Yeah. Yeah.
So DNA
very
has been
good.
A great tool. Hoping to do one of these days.
Going to do what?
We're hoping one of these days we can start doing some DNA work with chickens.
Yes, yeah, yeah. And it's pretty interesting with people, too, to track the heritage heritage of people as they've migrated through the thousands of years that they've gone.
Oh, yeah,
so,
yeah.
Have you had your DNA testing done, Jeanette?
I have not. I do have my family tree back to about 1590, so I kind of know where I'm from. But
wow.
My family were French Huguenots that were escaping being basically killed by the French queen. And so they left La Rochelle and settled in Arcadia. So I'm French-Canadian stock for the most part.
And then you married a Frenchman to boot to keep that,
I did.
That French cuisine in the family, huh?
Yep. And that reminds me, I'm going to miss the show next month because I'm going to be in France. And I'm hoping to bring back stories about French chickens. I'm going to try and connect with some of the producers because I'll actually be in some interesting chicken country around Normandy and Brittany. And so I'm hoping to meet up with some producers over there. But my colleague Jennifer is going to be on the show next month, and she's formulating what she's going to talk about, so she's going to keep me in the dark until she's made her final decision. But Jen Kendall will be representing ALBC next month.
Excellent, excellent. Okay. Well, Jeanette, thank you so much for coming on. Again, we've been talking with Jeanette Barringer, our special guest today. She's with the American Livestock Breeds Conservancy, an organization that just does wonderful work in saving these antique and heritage breeds. And, of course, once a breed goes extinct, it's gone forever. So the work you Jeanette, and the ALBC down there is such a service to the entire world, and we thank you so much.
Well, thanks for having me again, and look forward to talking to you in August.
Absolutely. Have a bon voyage, and I'll be at home.
Merci beaucoup.
A bientôt.
Bye.
Bye-bye. The American Livestock Breeds Conservancy, you can call them to join a membership. You'll be supporting a wonderful cause. Their number is 919-542-5704. 919-542-5704. You can get online and contact them at www.albc-usa.org. ALBC-USA.org. So that's the American Livestock Breed Conservancy. All righty, we've got just about 4 minutes left. Jesse, I'm going to bring you online to talk about Bitbird here. And I've invited Jesse to be the co-host tomorrow. So that way, but it won't be a dull show, that's for sure, with Jesse online. And Jesse, are you there?
Yes, I am there, and you're right, it won't be a dull show, Pat, but I think you're bringing me on. I mentioned in the chat room, just so I don't post pictures of you when I scour the internet for the latest on Pat Foreman.
That's right. I'll have to keep bribing you, just unless you put me in these string dresses with really good-looking chicks in my handbag. I like that one.
Yeah.
That was pretty
good. Yeah.
Yes, you've been very kind to me compared to how you've been to Whisper, Andy.
Well, It's not me. It's just the pictures we find that, you know. But hey, Pat, have you seen there's another pair of chocolates I think we were talking about the other day? Do you see what they're up to right now? $1,109 with 6 days, 6 hours left to go. They're already at $1,100.
Oh, my God. $1,109 for a pair of chocolate. They're Orpingtons, right? Aren't they?
Bantam Orpingtons. Yes.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Wow, people are going to be breeding those Orpingtons like crazy.
Well, you know, we've seen it before. Kind of like a designer, that they call like designer chickens, whatever, a new or not necessarily a new, but perhaps an undiscovered variety of a breed of chicken will come through, and they'll demand into the thousands for the first year, and then it's into the hundreds, and then within 2 or 3 years, it's a $5 to $10 chick again. So.
Yeah, well, we saw that with the pot-bellied pig and with the boar goats. I remember when the boars first came over here, they were, you know, $1,100, $1,200 for a goat, and now they're $30, $40,
$50.
So,
right.
Yeah, it's a phase. It's a phase. But if you get on the front end of it.
Oh, yeah, there was a lavender-colored bird. It's called the Coronation Sussex that was really hot for about a year or 2 years. Paul Bradshaw from Greenfire Farms brings in some unique stuff, and they do well for the first year, but you're right, you get out at the head of that wave and try to recoup some of your money.
Yeah. Well, good. Well, Bitbird, go to bitbird.com, and you can see those $1,100 chocolate buff Orpington bantams.
Yeah, what do you say we go half, Pat?
Do what? Go half? No. I'm still reeling from the Great Recession here. I'm trying to pull myself up from that. Well, listen, Jesse, we've only got about 2 minutes to go here, and I just want to come up and say tomorrow we're going to have Arlena Schott. She'll be talking with us about gardening, and that's always just an amazingly fun and factual field about gardening. Thursday we have Dr. Bridget McRae will be with us, Dr. McRae. And then, of course, we get to Fun Friday, which we always know is freaky, frivolous, frolicking, and fractured, often R-rated for Rooster Friday. And then Monday, our special guest is going to be Emily Lilly. She is a genetics professor at the Virginia Military Institute and just knows an awful lot about the history of poultry genetics, how they used to use them instead of fruit flies, for example, and how the genetics of the comb or the feathers, whatever. So all that is to say, we look forward to the next few days. Andy Schneider will be out tomorrow, but we'll be back in on Thursday. He is moving. It's his big get out of Dodge day and get down to his new home with a whole new start. So all that is to say, again, thank you, you chat room chicken ears, for clucking along and for staying with us today. Always wonderful input from our chat room chicken ears. And, of course, thanks to blogtalkradio.com for providing the radio, the chat, and the video services. Oh, you poultry pioneers, we love you so much, so, so much. Stay cool, be hydrated, and blessings to all, and may the flock be with you evermore. And thank you, Jesse. Appreciate you coming on.
My pleasure.
When you find yourself in danger, when you're threatened by a stranger, when it looks like you will take a licking, there is someone waiting who will hurry up and rescue you. Just call for Super Chicken.